I'm not going to call her the name I want to call her because y'all will screen grab it and it'll be on Peach Report tomorrow.
Hi, I'm Madison Malone Kircher.
And I'm Rachel Hampton, and you're listening to I See Why Am I.
In case you missed it,
Slate's podcast about internet culture. Before we get started, Madison, is there something you'd perhaps like to share with the class?
Yes, I would, Rachel. So in our last episode, our spoopy Halloween spectacular, I mistakenly identified a vine as being a clip from Project Runway, and it, in fact, was a clip from RuPaul's Drag Race. I deeply regret the error.
How very dare.
I will say, however, to the one person who DM'd me over the weekend threatening to pull my gay card, I'm keeping it. Just want to say, once and for all, that I do apologize to the Drag Race community. Don't hold your breath. There will not be a Notes app apology forthcoming.
Well, while they're not holding their breath, is there anything else?
Yeah. Let's go, Brandon.
Who?
Brandon.
Brandon who?
Star of the internet's latest meme. You know, Brandon.
Does Brandon have a last name? Who are we talking about?
Okay, a couple of our listeners have asked that we explain the Let's Go Brandon meme that has taken over in, let's say, the last month. Confusingly, Brandon is both a real person. He's a NASCAR driver named Brandon Brown. But as far as the meme is concerned, Brandon is Joe Biden.
I'm sorry. What? What? Brandon Brown and Joe Biden are the same person?
Let me take you back. This is my favorite kind of meme to explain because the takeaway at the end is, oh, I'm not missing anything. This is just really dumb.
Oh, great. I was really worried I was bad at my job because I still don't know what you're talking about.
Okay, so at the beginning of October, Brandon Brown wins this NASCAR race and he's being interviewed on NBC. And In the background, you can hear people at this NASCAR event shouting, fuck Joe Biden, fuck Joe Biden. And the host interviewing Brandon Brown is like, yes, you can hear them chanting, let's go, Brandon.
No.
Brandon, you also told me, as you can hear the chants from the crowd, let's go, Brandon.
I don't actually know if the host was, like, trying to pivot away from the fuck Joe Biden of it all. Are you counting the syllables? I'm watching you count on your fingers.
You know, yeah, I was. I was counting the syllables.
It's the same. It's four.
Okay. I just needed to check.
But since then, it has sort of taken off as like a censored way to say fuck Joe Biden. Like politicians on the House floor have said it. There was a Southwest pilot who like got in trouble for saying it over like the intercom from the cockpit on a plane. It's every fuck Joe Biden. Let's go, Brandon. Has taken over.
Okay, so I mean, based on the locale of where this meme originated, NASCAR, I'm assuming there's really two ends of the political spectrum that a fuck Joe Biden slogan could come from. I'm assuming this is the right side of that spectrum.
That would be correct. I mean, it is very funny to me, right? Because I'm one of those lawn signs. In this house, we agree, let's go Brandon, but possibly for different reasons than this meme's origin.
I mean, I'm glad that you said at the top that I shouldn't feel bad for missing this, because this is definitely part of a realm of the internet that I have very carefully tailored my algorithmic experience to not include.
It feels to me like a similar accidental workaround. Do you remember when it was announced that Donald Trump had COVID?
Oh, God, that was the best day ever.
Right. Wait, and people
sorry,
on
can
Twitter.
We say that?
You can say it. People on Twitter were tweeting the same number of asterisks as it takes to spell, like, yeah. I hope he dies.
Mm-hmm. I mean, on some level, it's funny. But on the other hand, it feels like a means to escape being regulated on a platform. And so that is a little scary to me. Just a bit.
I mean, just thank NBC. Anyway, I think that's really all one needs to know about Let's Go Brandon.
Well, great, because Let's Go Brandon is weirdly a perfect segue into our main topic for today.
How are you going to make this leap?
Today we're talking about Real Housewives of Potomac.
Right.
You, like Madison, might be thinking, Rachel, what the fuck does a MAGA slogan have to do with Real Housewives? To which I would say it doesn't really, but also it does, because one of America's, in fact, I would say America's greatest art form, gave us both Make America Great Again, and Real Housewives. And that art form is Madison's favorite topic, reality television.
Okay, you got there, but like I'm doing yoga. Like I'm full on warrior two. Like my body is stretched to make that leap.
I'm just keeping you limber.
It's true. I do love reality television. And you can tell that because the last time we talked about it on the show, I wasn't here.
Yes. In that episode, which was co-hosted by our producer, Daniel Schrader, we talked briefly about how social media has become the driving plot line of Keeping Up with the Kardashians. Rest in peace. But that's not true just of the now defunct E! Network series. On Real Housewives of Potomac, theoretically, the main draw is getting a kind of inside look at the politics and lifestyles of the Black bourgeoisie. And let's be real here. The plot lines about BBLs or Brazilian butt lifts and respectability politics and etiquette are simply sublime. It's prestige television. But the thing is, if you're not keeping up with the Instagram lives or the subtweets or the blog posts, you're missing out on, I would say, half of the show.
Okay, Rachel, I am convinced that you could keep talking about Real Housewives for, A, as long as my computer battery is going to last, and B, possibly for all time. But after the break, we're actually bringing in a second expert. We're going to be talking with Shamira Ibrahim, who is a excellent culture writer and critic who also does the Real Housewives of Potomac recaps for Vulture.com about the way social media functions on Real Housewives of Potomac.
More on that after the break.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now: getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Where to Be a Woman is the podcast celebrating the best of women's well-being. I'm Sophia Smith-Gaylor.
And I'm Saatchi Kaul.
And we're on a quest to find out where in the world women are living their best lives.
We're hearing from some incredible women about what their countries are getting right.
And picking the best bits for our female fantasy land. Because you can't build it if you can't imagine it first. Where to Be a Woman from the BBC World Service.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
All right, we are back, and I am ready to go to school and study up on the Real Housewives of the Potomac.
Oh, Madison, you have so much to learn. Lesson one, it's Real Housewives of Potomac.
Oh, no. Drop the, it's cleaner.
Mm-hmm. Lesson two for the uninitiated and Madison. The Potomac Housewives are a group of affluent Black women in the DMV area. Importantly, not all of them actually live in Potomac, Maryland, but they include Gisele Bryant, Wendy Osefo, Karen Huger, Candace Dillard Bassett, Ashley Darby, Mia Thornton, and Robin Dixon. So since this season is just wrapped and we're heading into the reunions, we're going to be joined by someone who actually knows what they're talking about. Shamir Ibrahim. Shamir, we're so excited to have you on the show. I've been trying to think of a way to get you on here for months now.
Thank you for having me, Rachel. Looking forward to the conversation.
Shamir, we're very, very glad you're here. But for our listeners, could you please disclose your housewives bona fides? You are quite the expert.
Yes, I am currently the Vulture recapper for Potomac. I have previously also done Atlanta. I've unfortunately obsessively watched this franchise going back to college, which I will not disclose what year that is because I will leave that where
fair
it
enough.
Is.
Not unfortunate at all. Very fortunate for us because I remember when I first tweeted that I was starting to watch this show, it was like December of 2020 and everything was depressing. And I remember you tweeted at me, you were like, girl, you have to keep up with what's going on online. Otherwise, you're not really understanding what's going on with the show.
Yeah. One of the things I tell people a lot is that, you know, while I do look at Housewives and reality TV as escapism, I actually think it's one of the most fascinating examinations of human behavior because it's a lot of examining how people think about themselves, how they think people perceive them, and how they think they can actually modify that, right? And become their own level of like producers. And it almost never works the way they think it's going to work, right?
Yep.
It almost inevitably fails. But it's this sense of like self-agency and self-ownership and how people actually really perceive how they can navigate that. And there's the odd chance that it succeeds, but inevitably, like, people's true character comes out. And of course, there's like a heavy level of producing by the actual producers who work to manipulate their own narratives. But watching that level of tension of people trying to like bring out their own narratives on social media now and using every level of mediums they have available to them to create this whole arc for themselves, while then their own persona like always defeating them by the end of it. This season, like if you think about for Potomac, you have Candace Dillard Bassett, right? Who at the beginning of this season, you know, coming off of the major conflicts between her and Monique, she was stepmom in charge.
I want to be more comfortable in my bonus momness. And so far it's been a haze, but I'm figuring it out as I go.
You know, okay. By the end of it, she's yet in another conflict, actually in several of them, and kind of reverting back to the same cadence that she was in last season.
Candace?
No. I don't give a
okay.
I don't give a I don't.
I promise you, you will.
And it kind of just speaks to the nature of how reality TV kind of iterates over itself.
Shamira, I love this idea that if you're not following along on social media, you're missing a large part of the plot of any given season of Real Housewives. But I'm curious how the inverse works. How does social media become an actual storyline on the show?
It becomes plot line in the show in a couple different ways. One is it becomes a plot line in the reunions very heavily. Like they talk about DMs and reunions and they talk, well, the reunions are like a very special kind of silo of how we talk about reality TV, especially in Bravo, right? Because we talk about it as if like, it's like this alternate universe, right? Where things kind of get expelled and then we never refer to them again, right? Like even in the universe of the season, they never say, at the reunion, right? They say back in New York, right?
Yes.
Like you never actually are allowed to say we were at a reunion. It's like when we were back in New York City, aka filming for 15 hours, right? And screaming at each other.
Like, you cannot say Andy Cohen's name on the show or else something bad happens.
Yeah, it's like we have to maintain the artifice of this being like a real organic experience. But that is where like we actually begin to actually navigate a lot of these interactions. Then actually throughout the season, they'll start to intersperse like the artifice of people producing themselves, right? In the last couple of seasons, that became a lot more accepted, especially with accepting that a lot of the cast members were leaking things to blogs. One notable one in recent history was like in Real Housewives of Atlanta, right? Where like the whole thing was basically constructed around like a leaked blog post about a stripper, right? That came to a party. And that was the whole buildup to it. So this kind of happens where now when there are like very caustic personas like in Potomac, who are known for like their very aggressive social media personas, they will show kind of that interaction, how that affects things. The problem kind of becomes that Potomac specifically is a show that is very layered in coded racial conversation and coded intra-racial conversation that doesn't necessarily easily translate to people who are not Black. So while there are some things that are very explicit, like, okay, Candace called Ashley a bed wench, right? I think even if you're not Black, you could get that that is something that is very out of bounds to say to someone who is a Black woman. But like, there are other things that are like not necessarily explicit to really discuss. Like I've tried to discuss in like, you know, my recaps that are not necessarily easy to tease out. And these are hard conversations to have with white audiences while are kind of more implicit within Black communities.
I mean, that's incredibly smart and just really kind of gets to the point of like the reunions and social media as separate from the actual show. I feel like those are the only places where the kind of undercurrents that you're talking about get discussed, like the respectability politics and the colorism and the kind of divide between like the Jack and Jill Blacks and the new money Blacks. Those are the only spaces that those conversations are happening.
And I think the big thing with Potomac as well is that the like reality blog world, you know, like that underbelly is dominated by Black and like Black queer people. And so because like those like places, like if you think about B. Scott, right, you think about Funky Dineva, think about All About the Tea, Lipstick Alley message boards, all of those sorts of like connections and those connective tissues are mostly viewed as either run by Black people or Black-coded in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. And Potomac as a community and as a show is a Black show, right? There's a level of connection there that is very intimate, right? So those narratives are coming well before the show starts.
First of all, I'm simply shocked that gossip blogs, a good and fun and messy thing on the internet, were created by Black and queer people. Go figure. who could believe that a great part of the internet had nothing to do with white folks. Shamira, do you feel like social media can help the white audience that you're describing keep up with the racially coded parts of the conversation on the show?
I do think it would help create a shorthand for some things, because I think Potomac, and Rachel, keep me honest here, I think it exploded as a fan base last season, right? Like so many people jumped onto it after there was this huge fight, right, between Candace and Monique. And now there are a lot of people who are coming in fresh who may not have necessarily watched from the beginning. And so there's a lot of like new perspectives to an audience that is not necessarily like in tune to a certain kind of Black community, which is different from Atlanta and Married to Medicine in the sense that they have a perceived level of respectability, right? But, you know, there's like this level of like grandeur and like performance and how they needed to present things. But now they've kind of put themselves in the position of like having this new fan base is like heavy camps. And like to shorthand some of these things would be appreciated in some ways, right? It's not always going to give you like a full level of like lexicon about everything. You're still going to miss some gaps. That's natural. But I can give an example. One time I did try to mention in a recap, yeah, colorism is a thing, but like it doesn't completely exonerate Candace from like all of her behavior. And like I accidentally caused like a ruckus in the Vulture comments section.
Say more.
Say more.
Well, I think people thought I was trying to say that like Candace had validity to like her tantrum. And then I got like a litany of responses, which I only check every so often, but it happened to be Indigenous People's Day. So I happened to have some time, right? And I just saw, oh, I just don't understand what color has to do with her being a bad person. And I was like, oh no, I might've done something wrong here.
Oh, like, no.
And so it was one of the rare times that I went in and explained myself where I was like, okay, listen, all I'm trying to say is colorism is a thing in the way that racism is a thing. It's always going to exist. Like
Candace will bring up colorism like online, or I think she brought it up at the reunion, or maybe Wendy did at some point. One of them brought it up during the reunion. And that's what's kind of fascinating to me as like Real Housewives of Potomac as a franchise is that I feel like more than Atlanta, it gets into, like you were saying, the intra-community dynamics more than anything else. And that's what I see discussed most often online, which is a product of the social media experience I've curated for myself.
Right.
But I'm always just curious as to what
white people are seeing when they're watching this show, right, and how much is just flying under the radar,
right,
and how much it's like Bravo or any of the cast members' responsibility to just be like, well, actually, there's an organization called Jack and Jill.
Right. This is your friendly neighborhood white audience surrogate asking, could we describe when you're talking about Jack and Jill, the organization, a little bit? I'm sure. Sorry, it had to be asked.
No, I
knew the reaction it would incite.
No, it's fun. It's not that it shouldn't be asked. It's just like, how could we describe it in a way that's not going to immediately piss people off? Okay. So on Wikipedia, it says that Jack and Jill is a leadership organization formed during the Great Depression, formed in 1938 by African-American mothers with the idea of bringing together children in a social and cultural environment to create a medium of contact for children, which will stimulate growth and development.
Rachel's head is just in her hands at this point.
Separately, there was a book that was written in, I believe, the 1990s by Lawrence Otis Graham called Our Kind of People.
A banger.
Which is essentially him as a person who grew up in like a community of people with means and how they looked at class before race. And Potomac tends to actually kind of mirror some parts of that in a way that blows up into the Bravo universe, because Potomac is kind of like the Jack and Jill blacks. Real House of Atlanta is kind of just like the regular blacks on like campus, right? In the quad, right? And so it's like kind of the different parts of like black digital and real life. And like all of them are kind of trying to put out one narrative of themselves. But at the end of the day, you only reflect back like who you are, no matter how hard you try to be one thing or the other.
The divide that you're getting to between Jack and Jill blacks and kind of everybody else, kind of going back to Madison's question about whether the online discussion will help white people understand what's going on the show, I feel like it doesn't at all, because that kind of nuance is getting lost between, like, the conflict between Candace and Monique was kind of Jack and Jill versus, like, Monique, who grew up kind of rough and was, like, right, now had money, but did not know like the proper etiquette. And so when you get these new viewers coming in because of the fight, they're missing all of the kind of social context that I think if you're keeping up with like the black audiences talking about it online or like the blogs or even like recaps written by black writers, like half of the show is getting lost in translation.
Right. Because if you remember after the fight, the first thing she said is you're a hood rat and you're fired. And like, Monique is like a regular around the way chick, but she's not a hood rat, you know, like she's just, you know, an around the way girl. Right.
Yeah.
But like, how do you explain like the nuances of that insult and why she's able to get away with calling Monique that specifically because she's brown skinned? And like, you have to be like deep in the recesses of black Twitter, right, to like search and comb through the hashtag and figure that out.
This reminds me of one of the questions I had, which is, do you think it's fair game for all, like, I mean, Robin's brought up blog posts, Giselle's brought up blog posts at this point, and every single time it gets brought up, the other person is always like, how dare you bring this onto the show? But it's driving the show at this point.
Rachel, can I ask a question about your question?
Yeah.
And both of you could answer. When you say that cast members act like bringing up these blog posts is sacrosanct, like you're not supposed to do it, are they just supposed to pretend the internet doesn't exist on the show?
Well, there was a time when they kind of did. Until like everybody was really, really bored during quarantine and everybody started going on Instagram Live. And then all the girls were just beefing with each other all day, every day, right? Until apparently Bravo actually had to tell them to intervene and said, you guys have to stop.
Because whoa, they were literally, I didn't know about that.
Yeah, like it was getting a little aggressive. Like all of them were literally hopping on Instagram Live. So that was when like fourth wall breaking kind of became big on this show. But it wasn't ever really standard to be like blog posts to be published everywhere. That wasn't ever really normal. So then after that, like on Potomac, they just started to become more like, well, fuck it, on the blogs and said this, on the blogs and said that.
There's something like quaintly analog about gossip blogs becoming a character on a show again. To me, that feels like the Gossip Girl era when they all
right?
get into like fake Gawker blogging.
And the funny thing is, on the gossip, like the gossip blogger side, as someone who's like spoken to a couple of them, like there's this idea that like they're getting paid, as in like transactionally paid. Mm-hmm. And they're not really, right? Like, you know, a lot of the casters are like, oh yeah, you know, Monique is paid the like paid XYZ mm-hmm. person to like, you know, be on their side. Like, they're not really getting paid. They get distracted by like, a, you know, association and quote unquote parasocial relationship the same way that anybody else does. So the person who they've been writing about regularly, the second they start paying them a little bit of attention, Monique sends a few essential oils, right? You know, like building that level of relationship. And then all of a sudden they feel like they have a relationship with a celebrity, right? Mm. You know, and that builds a level of affinity. So then all of a sudden it's, I know from an inside source, right, that XYZ thing happens, right? So it's not that Monique or whoever is actually paying them to give them favorable stories. It's that they feel like they've built a kinship with someone, right?
It is, in fact, cheaper to just be nice. They don't have to pay $1,000. So we've gotten into a lot about the ways that the differences between the kind of Jack and Jill set and the New Money set plays out on Twitter and on the show. But Instagram, the most visual of all mediums, probably is where you can see it more clearly, right?
Yeah, I think it's kind of started to blend a little bit more in recent seasons, but in the earlier seasons, you saw it a lot more. Like, we can compare, for example, Real Houses of Atlanta versus Potomac to see the most distinct blend, right? Mm. Someone like Karen Huger, who, you know, she has her little grande dame brand, right? Her whole kind of aesthetic, while it is around like big gestures, it's still around the idea of homemaking, right? Like the family unit. Whereas someone like Marlo Hampton, it's about flaunting and ostentatiousness. It's like, look at the brands I have, look at the labels I own, look at all the Coach bags I have, look at where I step out to, don't worry about who's buying it for me, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of the whole like soft launch partner thing, right? There's a, you know, vague man in the background who's sponsoring me and you don't have to worry about who it is.
Yes.
Like, that's the kind of like distinction between the aesthetic and how they interact with each other. Like, the idea is like wholesomeness and like, you know, presentation versus the whole like, we're out, we're stepping out, we're in demand and VIP wherever we go out. Like, Karen Huger does not care about whether or not she's going to be at stadium, right? Like, that's not the vibe that she's trying to give off, right?
Honestly, I kind of wish it was the vibe she was trying to give off. But I have one last question for you. And it's it's the most important question. Mm-hmm. What the fuck is up with Giselle's TikTok?
Oh my God. Honestly, I love Giselle. I will say this. I actually really think, as much as I've talked about Giselle being a light-skinned, like green-eyed bandit and villain, I actually do think Giselle seems like a great mom.
No, she does. The way her kids talk to her, I'm like, oh, you know, like, they, like, that's a good relationship. Like,
like, her kids literally tell her, like, she is, like, a mess every yes. single week. And mm-hmm. she's like, I receive that. But, like, yes. I say that as a, like, a way to transition to her TikTok, which is, like, one of the most amazing things, like, I've ever seen. Because, like, to give, like, a comparison, like, Ashley Darby has a TikTok, which is, like, basically her dancing to Doja Cat songs. But Giselle, like, honestly, it's high art. Like, by Giselle Bryan on TikTok, it is literally just, like, her, like, just pointing the camera at herself to, like, poorly synced songs. And it's also, like, song trends that are, like, 4 months old. You kind of have to just, like, decide what part of the TikTok speaks to you most. Like, oh, the mug that she pointed to in the middle of the collage, the random plant that she decided to pivot to.
Like, yes. Mm-hmm. It's like, really like a choose your own adventure. And in the back of your head, you just know, you can hear her children, like, looking at their looking at her TikTok and being like, what the fuck are you doing?
Like, it's very much giving like Mean Girls, like Amy Poehler, I'm a cool yes. mom, except yes. like, the thing is that Giselle is like, in some ways too beautiful to make fun of. Like, so you're just like, wow, like yeah. this is what happens when like, no one tells a light-skinned woman that like, she's not making sense. Like,
it really, yeah.
It's, mm-hmm. it's just bizarre.
Well, that is all of my questions. So I could talk about Real Housewives with you for quite literally 24 hours straight.
I'm sure we'll do it again soon enough in person.
Please, yes.
Once again, that was Shamira Ibrahim. Shamira is a culture writer and critic, and also the Real Housewives of Potomac recapper for Vulture.
All right, that is the show. We'll be back in your feed on Saturday, so definitely subscribe. It's free and the best way to never miss me talking about reality television. Speaking of upcoming episodes, November is National Novel Writing Month, or NaNoWriMo, and if you're using part of this mo to read your no, we'd love to hear about it. Send us a voice memo with the first line of your NaNoWriMo masterpiece, and we may use it in an upcoming episode. In the meantime, please leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends about us. None of y'all have hired a skywriter about us yet. I'm still waiting on that. You can also always follow us on Twitter, icymi_pod, which is where you can DM us your questions. And you can also drop us a note at icymi@slate.com.
ICYMI is produced by Daniel Schrader. Our supervising producer is Derek John. Forrest Wickman and Allegra Frank are our editors, and Alicia Montgomery is executive producer of Slate Podcasts. See you online.
Or on the Potomac.